From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block. There is trouble on the home front. Sales of existing homes fell in January by 7.2%. More evidence that the U.S. housing market is stubbornly weak. The decline follows an even steeper drop earlier this week in new home sales. Bad weather and a bad job market are partly to blame. The collapse of the real estate market drove the country into recession, and economists say housing must find some traction for a real recovery to begin. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
There's nobody hoping for a recovery in housing as much as home builders. Construction and related firms have laid off hundreds of thousands of workers. The number of homes getting built hasn't been this low in the U.S. in more than 50 years. Richard Duga is the CEO of Pulte Homes, one of the largest home builders, and he's not seeing the clouds parting just yet.
I'd love to tell you we're going to build a lot more homes, but it's going to depend on demand. I have to wait and see what's going to happen to the sales environment.
And for two straight months now, those sales of both new and existing homes have been disappointing. Things had been looking a bit better for housing. Sales were picking up. Prices seemed to have been leveling off in many areas. So Duga actually isn't that alarmed by these latest numbers.
I think there's a number of things going on. I think overall weather certainly played a factor in January, as well as what I would call the hangover from the tax credit that was going to expire at the end of November. That, of course, has been extended.
Duga is talking about a federal tax credit for homebuyers. Many people were scrambling to buy a house ahead of that November deadline. That boosted sales. And so now he says we're seeing an understandable slump. But with the tax credit extended, Duga expects that that will help support sales and create a more stable market through 2010.
Relatively stable, perhaps slightly improving from 2009, but definitely I'm not projecting a large rebound. There's too much foreclosure inventory that still has to be worked through the system the next couple of years.
In other words, millions of foreclosed homes getting dumped on the market means too many homes for sale, and that's pushing down prices. About 40% of all home sales right now are these so-called distressed sales. And there's another problem for the housing market going forward. John Shibley runs Lennox Financial, a mortgage company in Atlanta.
What I've been seeing based on our customer profiles is that 75% of the people that contact us are really owe more on their houses than what their houses are worth, and they don't even realize it.
Shibley's seeing a ton of people right now who are underwater, meaning they owe $10,000 or $20,000 or $100,000 more than their house is really worth. Some economists say 30% of all Americans with mortgages are underwater. Shibley says when people find that out, they often decide not to buy because they take a big loss selling their old house.
They're going to have to write a check just to sell their house. So the opportunity for someone to come in and say, hey, you know what? I've got $100,000 equity in my house. I'll go borrow $50,000 of that and then go buy a great house. You know, that doesn't exist either.
One big question for the coming year is how many of those underwater borrowers will decide to just walk away from their homes. Still, Richard Duga, the home builder, is optimistic that the government's support for low interest rates, combined with lower prices, will ultimately get more people to buy homes.
Now's a good time. I don't know when we're going to see this combination of low interest rates and low prices so it clearly is a time that a lot of value is being offered.
Of course, for people to take advantage of that, they'll need a job, and somebody will have to give them a mortgage. And in this economy, both loans and jobs can be extremely hard to get right now. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block. More than a million Americans without jobs will see their unemployment benefits expire Sunday at midnight because of one stubborn U.S. senator, Kentucky Republican Jim Bunning. He is blocking a bill that would have extended those benefits for another month, along with expiring health care assistance and a fix to prevent a huge cut in Medicare payments for doctors. Bunning says none of that is paid for, so he, for one, is saying no. NPR's David Wilna has the story.
The extension of unemployment benefits got approved last night in the House by voice vote. All that was needed for President Obama to sign it into law was the Senate's approval. But any senator can object to a bill, and that is exactly what happened when presiding officer Al Franken, a Minnesota Democrat, asked if there was anyone who had a problem with the benefits extension.
Is there objection?
I object.
Objection is heard.
The objecting senator was Kentucky Republican Jim Bunning, who earlier in life was a baseball Hall of Fame pitcher. Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin, who'd tried bringing up the benefits bill, chided Bunning.
I'm very proud of what you've done in your baseball career, but let me tell you one, this is a wild pitch you're throwing tonight, because it's a pitch that's hitting somebody in the stands. It's hitting an unemployed worker in Illinois in the stands. And that's a wild pitch which shouldn't have been thrown, Senator.
Seven other Democratic senators soon joined Durbin for a late-night standoff with Bunning, who reminded those colleagues that the Senate voted earlier this month to pass only those bills that don't add to the deficit.
And I'll be here as long as you're here and as long as all those other senators are here. And I'm going to object every time because you won't pay for this.
Shortly before midnight, the senators called it a night. This morning, Bunning continued objecting, so Democrat Durbin called it quits for now.
We will be back. We will try to get this done. And to those families, hang in there. After the politicians are finished with their speeches and debates, America's not going to give up on you. It's going to be tough for a while we work out this political difference, but unfortunately that reflects the Senate and where it is today. I yield the floor.
Bunning, for his part, left with a warning.
There are going to be other bills brought to this floor that are not going to be paid for, and I'm going to object every time they do it.
He'll get a chance to do so next week when the benefits bill will be back, added to a package of tax breaks. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
We're going to follow up this morning on the personal effects of the very public disaster that was the financial crisis.
Good evening, everyone. And the question everyone is asking is, how low will it go?
Stocks fell off a cliff, the largest single point drop in history.
The bloodshed continued overseas. Shares sank to their lowest levels since 2003.
Stocks lost around half their value from the top of the market to the bottom. Some, but not all, that value has come back. So this week we're asking how Americans save and invest for retirement now. NPR's John Itzde will be our guide. Good morning, John.
Hi, Steve.
So how have Americans responded to the changes here?
Well, there's no question that it's been financially and emotionally devastating. Not as devastating as losing your job, as millions of Americans have, but difficult nonetheless. After all, when we hit bottom, the value of American retirement savings in 401ks and IRAs had shrunk by $2 trillion. Mm. And in a survey done for the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, some people said the collapse in their retirement savings was equal to the stress they felt after the 9/11 attacks.
Wow, because you keep getting those statements, your money is just disappearing that you've worked and saved for.
Very scary.
And two questions come up. One is, did people change their investment strategies, and should people change their investment strategies?
Well, that's what we're going to look at this morning with the help of some experts and some regular folks. Let's start with Victoria Benalis, an educator from Idaho. She and her husband lost 40% of their retirement savings in the crash.
It was really frustrating, and we discussed, well, should we stop investing and invest all the money in a vacation home?
But Alice told me that she's lost confidence in the market.
I distrust it, but on the other hand, I also keep investing, hoping that somehow we'll find some kind of combination that will still help us save for retirement.
Steve Meyer says he and his wife lost close to 30%. That was typical for 401k investors during the crash.
It was scary, and then, you know, from there, you didn't know what was going to happen.
Meyer, who's 46 and works in Silicon Valley, says he and his wife may delay retirement because of the losses.
Hopefully the market will come back, and otherwise we could just adjust our spending both now and in retirement.
Working longer to make up for losses was one of the most common strategies cited in the Retirement Research Center survey. But given the shock investors absorbed, a surprisingly small number of people moved out of stocks after the plunge.
I think people were paralyzed with fear.
Alicia Munell is director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College.
Remarkably little movement occurred. On net, there was a slight movement out of stocks, but most people stayed pat.
Actually, says Munell, after they start investing, people hardly ever make adjustments to their 401k accounts. That meant that when the crash came, lots of Americans nearing retirement were overinvested in stocks or equities because of the big stock market gains in the 1980s and 90s.
If you're approaching retirement, you really don't want to have 65% of your assets in equities.
But what is the right balance of stocks and bonds, risk and safety in a retirement portfolio? Did the financial crisis change the rules? John Bogle, who founded Vanguard Funds, says no.
The real message, I think, is, you know, we're going to get big rises and big declines in the stock market. And if you keep investing through them, you will build yourself a terrific retirement account.
Bogle has seen a lot of ups and downs in the market during almost 60 years in the investment business. He says even in this uncertain time, the principle remains the same.
I'm a great believer in balanced investing.
And that philosophy is evident in one of Vanguard's flagship funds, the Wellington Fund, which invests two-thirds in stocks and one-third in bonds. Bogle has this simple investment advice: own stocks for opportunity and bonds for safety, and buy them in low-cost index funds, a product he invented. Index funds allow investors to own a broad array of assets, like all the stocks in the S&P 500, for instance. And Bogle has long told Americans that the percentage of bonds in a retirement portfolio should be roughly equal to your age. That way, your investment gets safer as you approach retirement. So if you're 60 years old, your nest egg should be 60% in bonds. But here's something that might surprise people who've heard Bogle give that advice before. He says you should count the value of your Social Security when you calculate your bond position. And for the average American, the value of Social Security equals about $300,000 worth of bonds.
If you accept that $300,000 is the value of the Social Security and you had $200,000, that could all be in stocks.
Since most Americans have much less than $200,000 in retirement savings, that suggests most retirement portfolios should be very heavily invested in stocks. But that's hard advice to follow after the crash, especially if you're close to retirement. What about international stocks? Well, Bogle is cautious. First, he says, many big American companies have global exposure. And he argues, in the past 15 years, when U.S. stocks have fallen, international stocks have dropped too, only further.
International diversification lets us down just when we need it the most. So it's not a panacea in any way, shape, or form.
But Nathan Gendelman, the investment director of the family firm, a Bethesda, Maryland-based financial planning company, thinks international investments are very important. The point, he says, is not to have all your investments concentrated in the dollar.
Should the dollar take a very sharp decline, it would hurt quite a few of our other investments. It would hurt our standard of living, quite frankly. And it would be extremely valuable to have investments that we're appreciating.
In addition to international stocks, Gendelman suggests buying a variety of foreign government bonds. There are mutual funds that allow you to do that. But in the new post-bubble, slower growth environment that economists are predicting, Gendelman says if you want to make sure your retirement funds grow, you're going to have to do it yourself by saving more, because no one can control the returns the market will give.
Bernanke can't control it. Obama can't control it. We can't control it. But what we can control is how much we spend and how much we save.
The other thing you can control is the fees you're charged. They can have a huge effect. An annual management fee of just 1%, for instance, can reduce your accumulation by 20% by the time you get to retirement.
We're listening to NPR's John Itzde going over some of the options for retirement. But, John, making any choice, as your report made clear, is difficult for some people. We're just busy. We're overwhelmed, especially now. How do people have time or confidence to change their investment strategies?
Well, that's true. And if that's the case, life cycle or target date funds could help. They're a single mutual fund that includes a mix of stocks and bonds and other assets. And here's the key. They're designed to automatically reduce the level of risk in your retirement funds as your retirement date approaches.
So you don't have to think about it anymore.
Exactly. And we're going to check out the benefits and drawbacks of those funds tomorrow.
And NPR's John Itzde, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Steve.
And you can find some background reading on this story by way of our Twitter feeds. You can follow us on Twitter at Morning Edition, and you can follow me at NPR Inskeep. That's INSKEEP.
About a third of uninsured adults below retirement age are between 19 and 29 years old, the so-called young invincibles. Many can't afford health insurance, and those who can often go without it. The reason? Well, why pay for something you might not use? So two law professors, Tom Baker from the University of Pennsylvania and Peter Siegelman from the University of Connecticut, have come up with an unusual solution. revive the idea of tontines. These were insurance schemes banned in most states here in the U.S. at the beginning of the 20th century after a series of corruption scandals. But Tom Baker says bringing tontines back could actually encourage more people, especially the young and healthy, to buy insurance. And what exactly is a tontine?
In its very pure form, a tontine is a contribution made by a group of people to a fund, and the last one living collects all the money. And in the health context, what we're proposing is that people who are in a health insurance pool will pay a little bit extra than they would ordinarily for the health insurance, and the people in the pool who turn out not to need the health insurance during the time of the tontine, which we would say 3 years would be a good number, at the end of that 3 years, the people who didn't use their health insurance divide up among themselves the earnings on the amounts that people paid to participate in that tontine connected to the health insurance pool.
So you would essentially be gambling on your good health.
That's right. But if you think about it, insurance is a gamble. Insurance is something that you buy that pays, you know, on a contingent basis. Do you get sick or not? And from an economic perspective, it's pretty easy to prove that people really ought to be buying insurance, because insurance is a magical transformation device. It allows us to shift money from times when we don't need it very much to times when we do need it very much. But it turns out that lots of people don't behave in that rational way, and we think particularly young people, because we think they're over-optimistic about their health outcomes. And so if, you know, adding a little spice to the insurance makes it more appealing, we think that's good.
You see, I see a lot of potential for mischief here, you know, like poisoning your coworkers and stuff. I mean, if you know you're all in the same pool and if they get sick and you stay healthy, you're going to make more money. I mean, my God, I can just see detectives all over this scheme.
Well, you won't be surprised to hear, and you probably know, that tontines have been a recurring theme in literature, detective novels, and I think the evidence that people have actually done that is pretty slim. There are things I am worried about, and this is something that my wife has told me about many times, is I'm concerned that someone may not go to the doctor if they're close to the end of the period and they're looking at that $1,000 or $2,000 bonus that'll be for them if they just don't go to the doctor for the next few months. And that I do worry a little bit about.
That's Tom Baker. He's a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He co-authored an article with Peter Siegelman from the University of Connecticut promoting tontines in the latest issue of Regulation Magazine. It's a quarterly put out by the Libertarian Cato Institute. Tom Baker, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.